I stole the title for today's session out of a magazine article I read. It was actually an editorial, and the writer was insisting that capital punishment was made for Timothy McVeigh. This is a very interesting assertion. It's sort of like a diamond in a way, and you turn it and it glints in different aspects. A lot of implications here. The death penalty was made for Timothy McVeigh. And it's like saying, if there's ever been any doubt as to whether the death penalty is ever morally justified, all doubts are put to rest. Because if anybody deserves capital punishment, Tim does. Likewise, it means that if you can mount an argument which shows why even in the case of Timothy McVeigh, capital punishment is not justified, then the ballgame is probably over with respect to trying to argue that case. I mean, if it doesn't work for Tim, it's not going to work for anybody less than a crime as heinous as that. But if you can make the case for the appropriateness of capital punishment for McVeigh, then any absolutist position which says capital punishment is never justified is down the tube. So a lot hangs on this. Let's just ask this question. If you think that Timothy McVeigh should be executed, and I were to ask you, why do you think he should be executed? Suppose I said, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say that Timothy McVeigh should be executed because if we execute him, we will send a message to would-be murderers out there that are thinking about bumping off people. Send a message that if they follow through on it and they get caught and convicted, that they will fry in the electric chair. And the reason we need to execute Tim McVeigh is to send a message to would-be murderers out there so as to try and dissuade them from following through on their plans and bumping off Uncle Charlie. And I think you'd say, I think you hit the nail right on the thumb. I mean, that's not why I'm in favor of executing Tim McVeigh. I think it's a lot simpler. You should execute him because he deserves it.
Cheaper.
Well, okay, but now right away we got out in front of us, implicitly, the two standard rationales or justification for having capital punishment. Now, one is what's called the deterrence rationale. And this really is a futuristic looking thing. It simply says the reason the state ought to have ready to hand capital punishment and mete it out in cases of first degree murderers is to make a public statement that if you're thinking about killing somebody, or if you do that and you get caught and convicted, this is what's going to happen to you. And the wager now is it's going to strike fear in your heart. You're going to back down from following through on it, and we're going to have some innocent lives saved as a result of people backing away from contemplated murders. Now, that's a standard variety of the deterrence argument. It's trying to dissuade would-be murderers who haven't done the deed yet from following through on it. Now, sometimes you run into little permutations of the argument where somebody says, well, there's another form of deterrence argument, namely that if you got in hand a convicted murderer, if you kill him, he ain't going to murder again. I mean, for absolute sure, you deterred him from killing again because dead men don't kill again. So we're protecting ourselves from future murders by this already convicted person. Now, that's sort of cutting it a little differently, but sometimes thought to be another permutation. Then we have what is called the retribution argument. And the short form of the retribution argument is simply says, we ought to execute convicted murderers because they deserve it. This is an entirely backward-looking thing. Doesn't give a whit as to whether we head off at the past future murders. It just looks back. It's a backward-looking thing and says, look, a heinous deed has been done, and to use a metaphor, the blood of the ground cries out for justice. Justice must be done. But there's sort of a long form of the retribution argument, and this is the one, I think if we get all the pieces, that this is the form of the retribution argument we need to wrestle with, because by far and away it's the most formidable one, maybe because it's the most complete form. Let's just waltz through it. See if you, store some stuff in the back of your head as we go through this. Is there any premise in this argument which seems to be debatable? We'll get to it later. The full-blown retribution argument starts off and says, crimes ought to be punished. I certainly don't have any problem with that. That seems to be a given. The second one says, the second premise says, that punishments ought to be proportional to the crime. The more serious the crime, the more serious the punishment, and vice versa. So if you had a schedule of punishments that had a $5 fine for rape and three consecutive life sentences for stealing a pack of double bubble gum from a 7-Eleven store, it would violate this criterion of proportionality. So punishments must be equal to the crime. Then it makes the announcement that the worst crime is murder. And the reason the worst crime is murder is because when you take away somebody's biological life, you take away everything they have. Everything. It's totalistic. And that's why it's the worst. Now, by back reference to the second premise, which says that punishments should fit the crime proportionally, if we've already announced that murder is the worst crime, then it logically follows that it deserves the worst punishment, right? Then we have the announcement that the worst punishment that we have to mete out is execution, for the same reason that we found murder to be the worst crime, because it takes away everything that the felon has. Ergo, the appropriate right punishment for first-degree murder is execution. I mean, that's the whole argument with all the pieces out there. Now, let's just start, since I think, you know, I don't know what deck most of you are dealing from here, but I suspect that if you were to hold that Tim McVeigh should be executed, it's probably because he deserves it. I mean, you're sort of dealing from a retribution deck. Well, let's just start with that. The retribution argument has been around for a long time and has been subjected to a lot of criticisms. But let me see if I can defend it in sort of a backward fashion here by showing how a true blue retribution theorist could respond and has responded to a number of garden variety criticisms which have been launched against the theory in years. And I'm not going to canvass them all. There are some objections to the retribution theory which are a piece of cake for people who are committed to it. How about this objection? Capital punishment, now this is an objection to retribution theory. Capital punishment violates the right to life, a fundamental, absolute, sacred right belonging to every human being, which deserves to be respected even in a murder. Piece of cake. The retribution theorist simply says, if you hold that position, that everybody bears an inviolable moral right to life, and whenever you terminate the life of anybody, you automatically become morally wrong. You can't justify killing in self-defense. You can't justify killing in war. I mean, you're in trouble. You're in trouble already. Moreover, one author that I know of has responded with sort of a thought experiment. What would you say if? Suppose that you were in the courtroom or in the jury for, oh, let's say John Wayne Gacy. Remember the guy down in Illinois that bumped off the kids, carved them up in little pieces and put them under his ports and so forth? He was executed finally a few years ago. Now, what this author says, imagine this little thought trip. Imagine John Wayne Gacy having at least a chance to speak, like to the jury, after his conviction, and the jury is about to determine whether he should get the death penalty or not. John Wayne Gacy comes up and says, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I want you to know that I bear an inalienable moral right to life. And if you take my life, you are violating a sacred moral right which is inviolable, and I want you to think about that when you go to determine what I should be sentenced." And this guy says, "I don't think anybody here is going to accept that appeal from John Wayne Gacy or from any fellow. And so if it isn't even persuasive when it comes from the mouth of a felon, it's bound to be less persuasive for anybody else trying to run that case for." Well, another argument, I don't know whether you've heard this, it says, this is against the retribution theory, capital punishment is nothing but legalized murder. Now, let's fill out what this argument is. I mean, the claim here, there's some alleged contradiction at law in the way the law is written, according to this argument. On the one hand, this objector says, you know, we have laws. We lay it down as wrong for me to waste any of you, okay? But, I mean, that's wrong. But then it turns right around and says, when a state wastes somebody in an electric chair or the gas chamber, that's okay. And now, apparently, we're tripping on our shoestrings here, because the same act is judged wrong if I do it to you, but the same act is judged okay when a state does it to somebody else, and so you've got an inconsistency. Now, this is usually summed up in a phrase that capital punishment is nothing but legalized murder. Now, the way the retributionist is going to respond and simply say, this is a cheap victory, because you're trying to win an argument by label. You're calling capital, you're saying capital punishment is legalized murder, and then if we ask you, what do you mean by murder, don't you mean unjustified killing? I mean, isn't this what you mean by murder? A murder is a killing, but when you say something is murder, you're saying it's morally unjustified, aren't you? So if you come and say, well, capital punishment ought not to be meted out because it's just legalized murder, then you're rendering yourself subject to a fallacy called begging the question. In other words, the retributionist will come back and say, hold it. Whether or not capital punishment is morally justified or not is exactly the point of this debate. Isn't this what we're talking about? And you're just trying to settle things in advance by labeling and saying, well, it's nothing but legalized murder. I know what you mean by murder, unjustified killing, but somebody's going to say, but I thought this was what we're talking about, whether it is or not. And you're trying to foreclose the whole discussion, right, you know, right at the outset. Now, here comes an objection which we've heard many times. And this is an objection that can be launched against the deterrence theory. But I submit this is also a piece of cake objection. It says, we ought not to mete out capital punishment, even to first-degree murders, because it's technically possible that in meting out capital punishment, you might convict and execute an innocent person. Okay? Right. Now, this is not just hypothetical, because we can document the fact that there have, in fact, been people who have been innocent, who have been executed, evidence withheld at the original trial comes out later, and now this argument simply says, look what you've done. You have committed an irreparable harm. An innocent person has died, and there's no way that you can make compensation. He's dead. It's an irreparable harm. and it ought to take your moral breath away. So what are we supposed to conclude from this argument? Don't even tempt fate. Don't even pussyfoot with capital punishment, lest you fall into this irreparable harm and commit this terrible wrong. So don't even have it lying in wait in your state for murders. Well, the retributivist comes back and has a number kind of responses to this. The first response is to simply say the conclusion, therefore we ought to get rid of capital punishment on the grounds that we might convict an innocent person. That doesn't follow from all the facts you've just given. What you've told us is that juries now and then, in all honesty and everything, unwittingly convict someone who's innocent and we send them to the chair and so forth. The retributive is going to say, but it doesn't follow that therefore we should get rid of capital punishment. All you're speaking to there is we better clean up our litigational act. It doesn't show that capital punishment is the inappropriate punishment for the crime, does it? It doesn't speak to that issue. I mean, all this points out, if we've got problems in convicting innocent people, we better clean up our litigational act, have higher standards of evidence presentation, more racially neutral representation on juries. I mean, it doesn't follow that we have to eliminate capital punishment. In fact, the retributives might say it also trades on the assumption that there are no clear cases of guilt. If there are any clear cases of guilt of first-degree murder, then in those cases, capital punishment is the right punishment proportionally and racially, right? Are there ever any crystal clear cases of guilt? I mean, if so, capital punishment ought to be meted out. How would you like to be an attorney representing Jack Ruby? I mean, the guy that shot on public television Lee Harvey Oswald. I wouldn't want to be saddled with the notion, well, he really didn't do it, would you? I mean, the evidence is overwhelming, and the point of the retributive is that if there are any clear cases, then in those cases, it ought to be meted out. Then the retributive might come back and say, sounds to him, the retributivist, like this, we shouldn't have capital punishment because you might execute an innocent person, really implies this notion. Until we get juries who are infallible, we should not mete out capital punishment as the punishment for murder. And of course, we never will have infallible juries, and so it could be no fun. The retributivist then will point out, says, well, that has an interesting implication. If the death penalty is the right appropriate punishment for murder, then this position seems to imply that everyone who commits any other crime should receive the appropriate punishment except murders. Right? They end up being sort of privileged. They're the only people that commit a crime that is not punished with the appropriate punishment. But everyone else can. So we make murder sort of an exclusivist protected area. The question is, do you want to live with that particular implication? Now, I suppose if you wanted a real cheap shot, cutesy comeback, somebody said, well, capital punishment is nothing but legalized murder. A short and sweet way would simply say, in other words, imprisonment is just legalized kidnapping. I mean, you could play that argument at a game. But so the retributivist sort of Teflons all these kinds of things, finds them a piece of cake. But I think that there are some objections to retributivism which are a little harder for retributivists to handle. Now, retributivism rests on the old doctrine of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You can see that. And remember the second premise? The punishment must fit the crime. Fit the crime. Well, let's just take a little microscope and move in on fit the crime. Retributives, what do you mean by fitting the crime? Now, most retributivists are puzzled by anybody asking a question because they think it should be intuitively obvious. I mean, what do I mean by the punishment should fit the crime? I mean that punishment should be equal to the crime. Great. Now suppose I ask, what do you mean by equal to the crime? Well, here you usually don't get answers, and so this is where philosophy runs in and said, well, if you're not going to give us an answer to what you mean by equal to the crime, let's talk about what you could mean. Let's get a laundry list of possibilities of what it means to say that a punishment should be equal to the crime. We'll see whether any of them work. So you could mean that the punishment is equal to the crime in the sense that the punishment ought to be identical to the crime. Well, imagine what this would be. That means that we should rape rapists, we should burn arsonists who killed people, on and on. And we say, well, that's just cockamamie. I mean, that. What, the question is, why is that wrong? Well, we say, well, those are just barbaric. We don't want to get into barbarism, okay? So one of the problems here, if what you mean by punishment should be equal to the crime is that it should be identical to crime, that some of the punishments you're going to mete out are going to be, you're going to torture torturers and everything. I mean, it's going to cast us into barbarity. what else might you mean? I mean, you haven't told us what you might mean, so you don't mean by equal to the crime, identical to the crime. One other thing the returners might say. The first problem you have by saying equal to the crime means identical to the crime is going to get you into barbarity. But if you hold that equal to the crime means identical to the crime, in some cases, to follow through on that will not involve you in barbarity, but impossibility. Suppose someone is convicted of the crime of drunken driving. Now, wait a minute. I'm not sure, or a spy, spying. Well, what are we supposed to do? Spy on the spies? Somebody convicted of aerial hijacking, we're to aerial hijack hijackers. Convicted of air pollution? I mean, what are we supposed to do, pollute them? I mean, if that's what you mean, I mean, it just gets cockamamie here. I mean, it's not barbarous, but impossible. Now, the retributists come back and say, now you're making mock of my position here. I mean, that's stupid to think what you mean by equal to the crime is identical to the crime. What I mean by equal to the crime is this, that the suffering experienced or given to the convicted criminal should be equal to the suffering of the victim. There ought to be an equality of suffering. Well, I don't know. This is really difficult here because how would you ever go about measuring how much suffering has been produced by an aerial hijacker? I don't know how you get a handle on this.
Money.
Huh?
Money.
I thought we were talking about just pain and mental and emotional.
You have to pay $500,000 or $1 million or $2 million. Or I don't know how much OJ had to pay, but you know, to that helps the pain. That's painful to do.
You mean what? The measure of how much pain? Oh, that's interesting. That's what economists call shadow pricing in a way. How much pain you suffered is. How much would you have to put in my pocket for me to feel back, you know? Okay, well, that's it. Yeah, okay. All right, maybe you can do it. I just find it really troublesome here as to how you get a handle on, you know, how much pain has been caused by a spy, because that's the amount of pain we're going to heap. And I also think there's worse things. I take it, you know, that prostitution is a crime, and now we're supposed to heap on the prostitute the amount of pain that she... I mean, this is strange stuff. I mean, you know, this can't be what somebody could consistently mean by equal to the crime.
But just to defend the spy thing, the whole reason Romano is probably espionage, she's probably going to jeopardize life or monetary national security, so cause pain would be probably physical.
But we have to quantify it somehow in order to know, you know, when we have enough.
The possibility of what the occasion for what he was doing, I mean, whether it was photographs or intelligence or just information.
But we're still trying to, you know, what the argument is, we want him to suffer as much as the suffering he caused to others. And we're trying to get a barometer for measuring suffering. And that doesn't seem to work. Now, by this time, the retributionist is getting a little... We simply said, you know, we didn't make up this principle that the punishment should fit the crime. You did. We're just trying to figure out what you mean. You mean, I mean equal to the crime. Well, you don't mean equal in a sense of identical, and you don't mean equal in a sense of equal suffering, and that can't be because that ain't going to work. He said, well, I mean, what I mean by equal is that the punishment ought to be proportional to the crime. Proportional. Well, what does that mean? Well, what I mean is this, is that the schedule of punishments with respect to the crime should be such that for the greater the crime, the greater the punishment, and that's what I mean. Well, now you can come back and simply say, well, yeah, you dictate in the third claim here that, the fifth premise or something, that murder being the worst punishment, or the murder being the worst crime, it deserves the worst punishment. And then you quick in the next thing to say, and the worst punishment is death. But what you might object is, would you like to talk about this? What do you mean the worst punishment is death? I mean, how do we determine what the worst punishment is? Now listen to how this is going to go. I'll bet you with a nanosecond of imagination that you could think of some punishments a lot worse than death. I mean, you know, hanging him up and vivisecting him alive and pulling out his entrails and so forth. You know, we haven't begun to fight. I mean, you say, what? I mean, geez, you want the worst punishment? A little fantasy here. I mean, I think of all kinds of Chinese torture methods and everything. And then we want to say, oh, well, you can't do that because that's barbaric.
Cruel and unusual.
Barbaric. Barbaric. Oh, the reason we can't go for dragging him through acid and all this kind of stuff is because that's barbaric. Well, this is a really interesting sort of an argument because now we're rejecting that. The retriever is rejecting that on the grounds of barbarism. Now, let's see what it is that is now being approved. Well, hanging by the neck until dead, having 3,000 volts of electricity pulse through one, so one's whole chest cavity opens up and urine comes out and blood and everything, okay. And then we have gas chambers in which people's faces turn blue and they suffocate. We got to get rid of, you know, of vivisecting people alive and pulling out their injuries, because that's too barbarous. But as far as, you know, having people turn blue in the face and so forth, I mean, that's okay. It's sort of interesting to look back on that in the history of the United States, what we have gotten rid of on the grounds that they're uncivil punishments. We no longer allow people like the Puritans did to put bad people into stocks on the village green. Too barbaric. We no longer allow ball and chain, expatriation, all this kind of stuff. That's too uncivil. But, you know, electrocuting somebody? Really? I mean, we've got a barbarism scale here? I mean, you talk about the worst punishment. Why is it that the worst punishment is death? I mean, we can think of a lot of worse punishments, and then if you say, well, we can't go that route because that's too barbaric, well, now we're back to assessing whether or not the four or five methods we have now are barbaric. In comparison to what we got rid of, which we thought were barbaric, I mean, these are pretty Conan-ish, you know? The stuff we got left. Well, let's go to the deterrence rationale. Now, let's just consider the garden variety deterrence rationale. It's the one that says the reason we ought to have capital punishment is because when the state executes a criminal offender, they send a message. Sounds like George Wallace from yesterday. Send a message to Washington. Send a message to all those would-be murderers out there that if they're going to think of bumping somebody off, they better think twice and thrice because, you know, they'll get it in the end. And presumably we're going to have some people back down. from committing murders, and we're going to have innocent lives saved. Now, the chief problem with the deterrence theory is this. It has to do with evidence, the evidence base, as to whether capital punishment really does deter murders. I mean, it's an evidentiary issue. And more precisely, the question is, is capital punishment a more effective deterrent than life in prison? I mean, it's not just does capital punishment deter, but is it a more effective deterrent? I mean, that's what it's about. And the problem here for deterrence theorists is that the evidence as to whether capital punishment is a uniquely more effective deterrent than life imprisonment, the evidence is inconclusive. There we go. Inconclusive. Hundreds of studies have been done comparing contiguous states that have capital punishment and those that don't, and all this kind of stuff to determine as to whether or not, you know, states that have got capital punishment have less violent crime and so forth. And the bottom line is that the evidence is inconclusive. I mean, some studies say they do, some studies say they don't, some studies are methodologically sound, others methodologically rotten, so you take all that in and you get inconclusive. Now, this is really an interesting issue here, because if the evidence is inconclusive, it's just that, inconclusive. You can derive no conclusion from inconclusive evidence. Unless you come in with some sort of burden of proof. Suppose I say, well, it's never been proven false that capital punishment doesn't deter, therefore it does. Well, I can just say, well, fight fire with fire. Never been proven true that capital punishment is a more effective deterrent, therefore it doesn't. I mean, two can play this game. So that just shows you that arguments and silence go both ways and settle nothing. Now, what do you do if you're a card-carrying deterrence theorist and you have to concede the obvious that the evidence as to whether capital punishment is a more effective deterrent or not is inconclusive? Well, I mean, you're not down and out because it hasn't shown that you're wrong. Well, the typical move then on the part of people who want to plump for the deterrence theory is to say, okay, the evidence is inconclusive, so we're going to have to, I'm going to have to fight for my position with a different argumentative tack. What we're going to have to do is ask, even though the evidence is inconclusive, whether it's plausible to believe that capital punishment is a more effective deterrent than life in prison. Now, we're resorting to a plausibility argument. And the deterrence theorists will typically come up and say, I do believe that it's plausible to believe, irrespective of what the evidence says, which is inconclusive, plausible to believe that capital punishment is a more effective deterrent than life in prison. Why? Reason number one is an alleged general truth about humans. True or false? Does this describe your life? That when you're contemplating undertaking some activity that has some risks attached to it, that the greater the risks involved, the more you start thinking about whether you want to involve yourself in that. And when the risks are getting really big, you sometimes back down and say, it ain't worth it. I mean, does that ever describe you? I mean, like, the greater the set of risks, the more I'm going to think about whether I want. I remember, just to give a personal life example, after my dad died, my folks had a cabin up in northern Michigan. And my dad had put that thing up, and it wasn't finished inside, just, you know, bare stud work and electrical and plumbing work and so forth. And so my mother said, listen, why don't you take some of the insurance money, we were starting to have kids at the time, finish off the inside and so forth, and make it nice, and you guys use that, you know, during the summer. And I said, well, that's great. So I went out there all alone, you know, took a table saw and a bunch of equipment and everything. And it's pretty sort of way out in the boonies, 26 miles from the nearest city, you know, with a hospital and so forth. So I was out at like 5:30 one morning, and I was trying to cut lengthwise a great big 4x8 sheet of wallboard, you know. And I knew, you know, it was going to start drooping down by the time I pushed it, so I had a sawhorse at the end. I didn't have anybody helping me, so I was pushing this thing through, and then we get within about 6 inches of the end, and I feel the board, it's starting to, you know, and I sort of put my hands down like this and keep pushing that thing through, you know, it just flips up, and my thumb goes right in the saw blade, and man, there's blood spurting out all over, and I run in, you know, get a towel and put it around my finger. I'm all alone, you know, and I drive one-handed down to Traverse City, going to the emergency thing, and I said, why am I telling you all this? I'm telling you, I'm never going to do it again. That's the point. I mean, I won't touch that with a 10-foot pole, but that illustrates the point. I mean, I know that that's a risk, that's a harm, that's grave to me, and I ain't going to do it. And so the question is it a good argument from plausibility? Is it plausible to believe that the greater the potential harm, the more reflective you're going to be about whether you want to run it, and sometimes you're going to be back down? I mean, if that's a general truth, then there's some plausibility here that capital punishment is likely to be a greater deterrent than is life imprisonment. The retributives is also, or the deterrence people are also going to say that there's at least anecdotal evidence for the truth of their claim, because there's at least anecdotal evidence that sometimes when wardens or prison chaplains go to people on death row and say, I have news for you, the government has just commuted your sentence down from death to life imprisonment, and they go, oh, God, thank you. Does this illustrate something concerning the fear potential of any of this? I'm going to leave this off the board. We may get to it later. What the deterrence theorist is also going to say with respect to this inconclusive evidence thing is this. He said it's really interesting to think about what kind of evidence you really need. I mean, what sort of evidence do you really need to find out whether... What the deterrence person is going to say is it plausible to believe that anybody ever backed down from committing a murder because they feared the possibility of death? Did anyone ever do that? Anyone. You know? And then the deterrence theorist is going to end up saying there's a funny thing about getting appropriate evidence as to whether capital punishment deters, because when you stop to think about what the technique would be, it's a little crazy. I mean, I would have to sort of like go around with a NBC microphone and say, Judy, did you ever think of killing anyone and back down from doing, am I going to get an honest answer from you? Probably not. So the kind of test that you really need, you can't really conduct because nobody's going to be honest. But then the piece de resistance argument, which some of these people, not all, but some use, is that no wonder the evidence is inconclusive as to whether capital punishment deters, because all of us are incredibly insulated from the horror of capital punishment. I mean, it's done far and away in little rooms in prisons, which are an execution, are just attended by prison personnel and some journalists and so forth. None of us have fear struck in our hearts because we've never witnessed one of these. Now, the argument here is American people should be exposed to the horror of capital punishment, and all we're doing is insulating them from it. And a very interesting case came up in 1991 when California got back after a 24-year moratorium on capital punishment. They got back into the capital punishment game, and the first person to be executed in the gas chamber was a convicted fellow by the name of Robert Alton Harris. And radio station KQED in San Francisco petitioned for permission from prison officials to bring cameras you know, photo cameras in there and broadcast the execution live on TV. Well, the prison people turned them down. And then it got to be a First Amendment rights kind of an issue. Geez, you let reporters in with steno pads, but what about photojournalism? I mean, that's, you know, why do you, I mean, is this the violation of our rights? But I think that many deterrence people would simply say, that's what we need. That's what we need. I mean, Americans should see this, and then you have a real test as to whether capital punishment deters. I mean, they've never rubbed their face in the reality of this. Nobody is. I mean, we need to scare them. Then we'll take our test to see whether or not there's some difference. But, I mean, the whole thing is we've all been insulated from it. There's the problem. Well, there are some objections to deterrence. Somebody says, deterrence. You're not going to gain an awful lot, because the truth of the matter, guys, is that 80% of homicides are crimes of passion. The person who commits a murder is either in a rage, under alcohol, drugs, jealous. I mean, they're not thinking about capital punishment. I mean, they're off the deep end. So what kind of yield are you going to get if you've got capital punishment? If 80% of them are crimes of passion, you're not going to get a lot for your efforts, are you? Well, of course, the deterrence person is going to say, yeah, well, what about the other 20%? I mean, suppose we save anybody. I mean, the 20% that do. Now, unless you're going to hold this view, is that every one of the 20% that are thinking about it believe that they'll never get caught. And we'll go ahead and do it anyway. I mean, unless you have that hypothesis. The deterrence person says, so 20%? I mean, that's still innocent human beings' lives that are saved. I mean, what's wrong with that? Well, let me try something out on you. I would like to run by you. You know those ads that you see on television where, you know, you can get two CDs with, you know, the whole history of rock and roll or something. You can't buy this in any store. Call 900-888-555, blah, blah, blah. Okay, this little trip I'm going to give you in terms of maybe a constructive alternative to capital punishment, like you can't buy in any store. I've never heard anybody run this one. So my wife thinks I ought to be the president of the Society for Lost Causes. Maybe you will be after you hear this too. But let's think together about this. And let me just read a couple of purple paragraphs out of an article which appeared in a Wisconsin paper, which was my inspiration for this. The title of this article is Confrontation Can Help Both Victim and Offender. Let me just read a few paragraphs. This is La Crosse, Wisconsin. Margie Meyer wanted to meet face to face with a man who was accused of killing her husband. The 32-year-old La Crosse woman had much to say to Jeffrey Raines, who was convicted of homicide by intoxicated use of a motor vehicle, for running over her 25-year-old husband, Daniel, on Thanksgiving Day, 1986. I wanted to meet with him, yet I didn't want to, she said. I'm not a cold-hearted person, but I let him have it, and I felt better that I did. Through the Victim-Offender Reconciliation Program in La Crosse, many victims or their families are getting a chance to confront offenders. The voluntary program, started in 1986 in La Crosse by St. Francis Community Programs, gives the victim of a crime and the offender a chance to meet and discuss the impact of the crime in front of a trained mediator. Well, Meyer came prepared for her meeting with Raines in March 1987, only 4 months after her husband's death. She took her 2-month-old son, Andrew, with her to the meeting. She went up to Raines and said, "Here's my son, who will never know his father. She said at first Raines didn't look at her infant son or at her, but he later did look, and he said he was sorry. But I said, I'm sorry doesn't cut it, Meyer said. I had all these nasty feelings and I was feeling, and I had to deal with being a single parent with three kids, and it was real scary, and I was in real bad depression. Cutting to the end here. Both Meyer, the widow, and Raines, the convicted driver, said that this reconciliation program helped them. Now listen to what goes on here. Meyer said, I had a lot of anger, and I made him feel like crap, she said. I was rude and crude, but I had to let it all out, and it did me a lot of good to deal with a lot of problems I was having. She also said that she felt she had some input in the criminal justice system. Circuit Judge Peter Pappas accepted some of her recommendations. Listen, she and Raines negotiated an agreement in which Raines had to pay for her husband's medical and funeral bills. She was also instrumental in sentencing recommendations that Raines not go to prison. Okay, where am I going with this? Just fantasize with me a little bit. How about a new approach toward dealing with people who have convicted first-degree murder? Now, Raines didn't do that, but let's just ratchet this up so we're thinking about the issue we're thinking about here. I think that one of the oft unappreciated facts about the American penal system with respect to those who have been convicted of capital crimes, and especially murders, is this. All we seem to be concerned with is, what are we going to do to the guy that convicted the murders? And somehow, it never gets into our ken about the what I'll call the lingering victims, the survivors, the Marjories of this world. Look, suppose Raines had shot her husband. Just ask this question. What good does it do Margie if Raines is killed or is locked up and thrown away the key? It solves not one single problem this woman has to deal with. I mean, she's now a single mother. Her husband was probably the exclusive breadwinner. She's got young children. She is going to have to go out, maybe go to a vo-tech school and get some skills so that she can get a job, and she's going to have child care expenses. I mean, Raines is frying the electric chair, doesn't speak anything to any of these problems. Not one.
It doesn't speak to that problem, but it seems like it would speak to perhaps other emotional problems that she has. For example, I've heard of relatives of murder victims who have expressed relief emotionally that the execution of the person who killed their loved one has brought some closure to their lives.
Good.
And has been very meaningful to them in that sense.
Okay, let me just absorb that. I think it's very good. How about, now I'm trying to bring Humpty Dumpty together here. We have the problem of the forgotten victims, the survivors of these people, for whom the execution or life imprisonment of the offender does nothing. It solves not one problem, okay? Well, maybe it does, but we'll get to it. How about if we had a new wrinkle? I'll call it victim's choice, okay? And here's how this thing would work. Raines bumps off, let's just assume he shot him with his first degree murder. Raines bumps off Margie's husband. He is convicted of first-degree murder, and let's suppose that Wisconsin, contrary to fact, has got the death penalty, and Raines should go to the electric chair. Okay? I mean, that's the way it's going to be. Now, how about if we inserted this new wrinkle in? What would be coming to Raines, if nothing else happened, is he'd fry. But suppose after the conviction, and we know that, let's say we have mandatory death sentence. Suppose after the conviction, some friend of the court or some court liaison goes to Margie and says, look, only if you want will we pursue the following thing. If you want, we will go and talk to Raines and see whether he's interested in the following kind of contract that he might generate with you. Contract would be this, that he'd have to serve some minimum time in prison. And we can negotiate what that would be. 10 years, 15, I don't care, we can argue about that. But there has to be some minimum time. But the contract would be that during this period of incarceration, he would have to take on an in-prison remunerative job, which brought money in, okay? And either all of this money would be garnished, let's say all of it would be, and it would be shipped off to Margie on a regular basis to help Margie deal with the problems that she's got. Okay? Now, if you say, oh, well, that's just crazy. I mean, prisoners working in prison for money. I'm telling you, I got three Time Magazine articles here. It's being done. It's being done in Minnesota. Lionel Lakes Penitentiary has got prisoners that are repairing Toro weed eaters better than some other, you know, people, and they draw a salary for doing this. People are doing telemarketing for major organizations from in prison. They're doing computer programming, you know, scut computer work, you know, which real geeks don't want to do. You get a monetary, okay, it can be done. I mean, don't say it can't be done because it's being done. Now, the court, and suppose Margie says, yeah, see what Raines says. And so the court person goes over and talks to Raines and says, okay, the victim is willing to negotiate. And this is the contract. Now the court might simply say, we put a dollar sign here that Raines has got to pay, like over this 10-year period or whatever he's in, he's got to pay X amount, I don't know how many thousand dollars. If you say, well, how are they ever going to come out with a figure for that? Well, all I would say is that in tort law, they do this all the time when people get busted up in automobile accidents. They put a price on what it means now to operate with, you know, without two arms and mentally emotional. I mean, they do this all the time, so I'm not worried that that can't be done. But there's some total amount which Raines has got to pay over this period of time before he's fulfilled his contract. Now, the liaison goes to Raines and says, okay, Margie Meyer's willing to negotiate. Are you interested in this? And he said, I'm not interested in that at all. In that case, we go with plan A, you fries. That's what we're going to do anyway, right? Okay. On the other hand, he says, oh, sounds good to me. Tell her I'm interested. Court liaison goes X, says, he's willing to negotiate. He's willing to take this court kind of contract. Now, the guy's still got to serve X number of years in prison, and let's just say that he defaults. I mean, we give him a certain amount of time, and if he's not coming up and he defaults on this, we go to plan A, right? Because what's he going to do anyway? Now, the question is, what would be wrong? Oh. There's two sides to this. I call it victim's choice. Margie might be approached by the court liaison which says, now only if you want, Margie, I'm getting to your point, only if you want will we do this. And she might say, I'm not interested, because that's just blood money from my husband. I'm not interested. In which case, I mean, she'd feel better if he fried. In which case, we go with plan A, which is what we're going to do anyway, see? Now the question is, would there be any likely positive upshot of doing it this way? Could be. Remember, 80% of the crimes, or murder crimes, are crimes of passion. I take it that these are moments of aberrant behavior in which the person is not being himself. the prospect, I mean, it's an aberrant moment. It's not his typical self. Let's just start with that. I mean, you know, simply because he did it once doesn't mean that's the way he is. And suppose he were to take up this contract and pay, start Margie back, you know, start paying these sorts of things. Would this be a nice discipline such that at the end of the 10 or 15 years, he could be released and we'd have reasonable belief he could return as a constructive member of society? I mean, why do we need to kill him? I mean, what good does it do to Margie?
Are you ready to...
Yeah, right. Let's just go with it.
Well, I guess the first thing that comes to mind is this is a blatant transgression of the ideal of proportionality here. First of all, the primary victim is the person whose life was taken away.
Right.
They're not going to be asking him what he thinks. They're going to be going to the secondary victim, or in most cases, there are many secondary victims. You know, that probably had a mother, a father, children, so, you know, do they get a consensus from this group of people? I'm getting a little off the subject, but instead of him being punished for his punishment being determined by the crime that he committed,
right.
Instead, it's being determined by the emotional state of the secondary victims. If he's lucky, he has people, the secondary victims are compassionate, and they say, no, I don't want him to go to the chair. If he's unlucky, he has uncompassionate secondary victims, and he fries. It has nothing, no relation to the crime that he committed.
Okay, so
it's a violation of proportionality.
You're absolutely right. So let's just do it. We're on a roll here. The first thing is that the retributors will simply say, you've got to be kidding, Peters. You've thrown justice to the wind. You really have. I mean, you've got a life that was taken. The blood on the ground cries out for justice. This isn't justice. How dare you?
After he goes through appeal, 15 years can go by, and no death sentence has been carried out. We have a man in Washington State who killed two bank tellers, and he's in prison. He has appealed, and then they said still he should hang, but by that time he got himself weighing 400 pounds. And Washington State had hanging when he was sentenced. And by the time they said that it would be cruel and unusual because he's so heavy he'd be decapitated, should he be hanged. So they are not hanging him. And now he's eaten himself into liver disease, apparently, and they're talking about a liver transplant.
Oh!
And it's been 15 years. And his family, the family of the women that he killed...
Are what? What? They're just...
It's terrible.
Terrible. They're getting no relief?
Close at hand. The
mother's dead.
Results, though.
But the... if he had not, you know, if he had not had capital punishment and he had been put in prison without all this appeal thing, it would have saved the state I don't know how much money, cleared the courts of all this time, and society would have been far better off.
But, no, wait, just let me respond and I don't hear you right.
I think.
Right. Sometimes it's said, the argument is run, we were talking before we started here. Here's a naive argument. The minute you hear it, you'll say, oh, who could ever run that argument? I actually heard people run. Capital punishment is really cheaper for the state than life in prison. Because when a guy's executed, you're not responsible for three square meals a day and a roof over your head and all this kind of stuff. So it's just cheaper to fry him, right? Than to feed and house him for 40 years. Now, the problem that's wrong with this argument is that what we're not paying attention to is the inordinate amount of money it costs for appeals.
Absolutely.
All right? And the amount of money for appeals just eclipses the amount of money you'd pay for 40 years to give them three. I mean, really, that's the way it works out. So, I mean, that argument doesn't work. But then I want to know, where does this go? Well, we should just have life imprisonment, because then you get out from under these appeals. My question is, why should we assume that if we mete out life imprisonment, we're not going to have any appeals?
Yeah,
I mean, are they going to go away? I'm not sure we get rid of anything.
Charlie Manson is
yes,
a good example.
The reality is that we do. I mean, we've statistically proved that 40 or 50 times.
Well, the people who get life sentences don't appeal?
They do run the appeals, but they don't run the multiple appeals. Typically, the typical appeal period on life sentences is 2, okay? And on death penalties, as she said, and we're between the 2 that we've put to death so far in this state and the 14 that are on death row, we've spent $117 million so far, okay? And every other state except Texas is close to us. We're spending so much more money trying to execute people than are happening. We've got the Ninth Circuit out here that tends to block all of that, but the reality is, this appeals.
Let me be sure I understand. They're appealing to not be executed.
Yes,
right.
They're finding reasons not to be executed.
So the argument is, if we back down to life imprisonment, it's not that we would have no appeals, but fewer.
Well, they'll remain the state level. Shekels on the federal level. It isn't the state appeals that's the problem. It's the federal appeals. Okay, and the only reason it's a federal issue is because it's a death penalty. If it's not a death penalty, it's not a federal issue anymore. I mean, that's the reality. We have a system here in this state where you're going to get an appeal. You're going to have probably 2 appeals, but that's it, and it's done. And you're not going to have.
So these statistics are your federal numbers that you're talking about.
What's that?
No, I just want to be sure I understand this. So the statistics you're quoting are these federal.
No, they're the total cost of appeals, including the state and federal appeals and housing and everything else.
But the state has a system for 2 appeals.
What's that?
You said the state has a system for a couple.
Basically, there. Sometimes there might be more, but basically.
So the rest of this is.
Absolutely. Everything she's talked about going on with this guy getting hung is federal appeals, Ninth Circuit. And it's not just that circuit, although that's the one circuit.
So it's also not just the state of Washington paying for it. I mean, it's all of us.
Yeah.
If it's a federal appeal, it's all of us paying for it.
Well, only in the sense that you pay for the judges. The defense attorneys and the prosecution are both funded by the state of Washington. That's not the issue.
He's not paying the defense attorney.
Okay, I'm pretty sure I understood.
The only thing the federal government pays is the panel of appeal judges. But I mean, that's not cheap.
I'm trying to understand this argument because it sounds as though what we started off with is if we're all, let's say, imagine we're all retributives. Somebody say, he really ought to get capital punishment because it's the right punishment for the crime. The only problem is, it's too costly to the public coffers to do it, given all the appeals. So while it's the right punishment for the crime, it takes us to the economic cleanest, you know?
Okay, I'm a judge, that's what I do, 16 years.
Come on.
And I don't have a problem with capital punishment. I think the public can choose that if they choose to, and they have in this state, okay? That's a choice the public gets to make. I don't have a problem with the concept, but I have a terrible problem with the amount of the expense. The amount of money could have solved a lot of problems in our schools. Sure could have solved a lot of problems, police and everything else.
So we're backing down from the ideal, trying to get into
ideals,
reality check.
Yeah, right. Ideals can be so expensive that they're not worthwhile. I mean, you know, we had one guy who wanted to die, literally, who came, fired his attorneys, said, kill me, Wesley Dodd, and did literally choose to die, and he went the quickest of anybody in the United States, and we were still in him about $3.5 million. This is a big expensive process.
But there was an intervention there, right? The people who felt that he didn't have that right to say.
Could be. Yeah. I'm just saying that you're going to have some, I mean, the cheapest guy in the world, the guy who wants to die, is going to cost you $3.5 million. That's real.
The case had a very beneficial result.
The Dodd case?
The case of the gentleman who would have been decapitated. Because it stirred the legislature into giving us multiple forms of execution.
Multiple forms of execution.
There will now be a choice. If you like capital punishment, you would like the result of that case. It may now be executed.
Yeah.
But I want to comment about your other point about enabling the victim to obtain benefit by the labor that the convicted person might do in the bigger about. Doesn't the O.J. Simpson case answer that? He was not found guilty of a crime because of the extensive burden of proof, but it was relatively easy to obtain a tort action government for deprivation of benefits. And that can be done, of course, in any case. because it's much simpler to prove a civil case where all that you're going to lose is money than it is a criminal case where you're going to lose your life.
Is your suggestion that we not try these under the criminal, but under...
I'm saying that if a woman has a good livelihood, et cetera, that she has currently a remedy which is relatively to a criminal action, simple. She doesn't have to wait until there's a criminal conviction. She can sue for tort damages.
Is that right?
Well, sure, she can sue, but the reality is that 1 out of 10 million people convicted of an aggravated murder has anything to sue for. I mean, we don't have very many O.J. Simpsons committing those crimes. You know, that's real. I mean, we have a gentleman now, the Martin Pang thing, who might have some money back there, or his parents do, but that's the last time we've had a wealthy, we don't have wealthy defendants.
Well, and O.J., even though he's got the money, they're not getting it. He's got so many ways of keeping it from the people collecting it.
That's where that matrix that you put up there, I mean, means and rationality, if the person has means and the person has rationality, they can weigh, it may become a deterrent, and if not a deterrent,
what would become a deterrent?
The death penalty. If the person had means and rationality, then they would have to realize they would be giving up something, potentially giving up something. If they commit a murder and got caught. But if they don't have means, or they don't have rationality, or both, what deterrence is
I understand that. I think you are blossoming a very interesting argument that can be launched against me, not just from the retributive perspective, but from the deterrence thing. Now, in other words, if you make a public policy that if you waste somebody, we're going to give you a chance to work it off with the victims. Now the question is, have you just let the wind out of the sails of, how much is that gonna be deterrent? You kill somebody and, well, we'll give you a chance to pay the victim. I mean, is that gonna make anybody back off? You know, I mean, that's what the deterrence person's gonna say. My response would be, is that I don't think it's that clean. Because what no one knows is what the lingering victim, the Margie's gonna say. Remember, she has the choice of saying, no way, Jose, that's blood money, let the guy fry. I mean, that's a big wager to take. So I mean, that would be my response.
Margie's making an awfully good argument for banishing death penalty.
I'm trying to ask us to reconsider.
Let the convicted.
I'm trying to talk about a restitution alternative.
Oh, it
a third way of going at this.
Sends him to life in prison and give him the job.
Right. But you have to give him some incentive. If he's going to have life imprisonment no matter what, I'm not sure you're going to get him to agree to this contract.
I mean, he doesn't have to agree. Right. Get a tort judgment against him, take his earnings in the future out of money that he's going to earn while he's still alive.
But he could just not do anything.
The only problem,
he's not going to get anything for it.
The only problem with that is we used to do it in this state until the unions found out that was taking jobs that people on the outside could have.
There's a problem. The unions are all over these telemarketing office assembly saying, geez, I mean, look at this. It's taking work away from our people. And besides, look what the taxpayers are doing. They're paying for 3 square meals a day. They're paying for whoever's head. Is he paying his own way in prison? No, I mean, we're paying all this stuff so that he has the freedom to go ahead. I recognize that these are problems. I'm not sure they're lethal, but I recognize them.
What about Timothy McVeigh?
Well, let's just live with this, because we started off talking about the Tim McVeighs. And what I don't know now is... I'm not sure that I want this victim's choice alternative available across the board to all people. You may want to separate out certain classes of criminals. I would think the most likely class would be those who committed the crime in a moment of passion, which is an untypical thing. I mean, they're probably just rather reformable. And to just cry those people or lock them up through the keyway, I'm not sure what we're accomplishing there. So there may be a subset of all felons, and the Tim McVeighs may be in another category.
I was gonna say, the son of Sam, after 20 years, I apologized, and my response was, oh, he's not insane anymore.
the son of Sam, you know, the guy that...
Yeah, oh, sure, yeah.
He gave some sort of apology, you know, rational apology for all he had done in the past and was real sorry about it. I thought, oh, he's not insane anymore. The thing with Tim McVeigh that's real interesting to me is he's supposed to be a pretty normal person. He grew up in a normal family and all the rest of it. And then all of a sudden, he started reading, you know, he went to the Army for one thing, and then he started reading these Soldier of Fortune magazines. So what's going on with this fairly normal person that made him change into this monster that we all see? I mean, I'd be really interested in keeping him alive to figure that out so he could use that as a deterrent for other people turning out to be psychopaths. Okay.
And then the question is, are we dealing with, can we say a priori, that Tim is unreformable?
No, I think he probably is a real normal
person. Well,
I don't
know. But somebody say, well, I don't care whether he's capable of being reformed.
No, I don't care, but I'd really like to know what the glitch was that caused a Tim McVeigh, because I bet we can do it again, and I'd like to stop that process.
Yeah, but they did that with Ted Bundy all the while they were waiting before they executed him. They waited and they watched and they had him analyzed and psychiatrists and so on, and what did they know? I don't know.
With,
we haven't heard.
He was a work personality.
The wrinkle with McVeigh, which is different, is slightly like a political prisoner in our time, and that is this element that it feels that the government has somehow gone astray, and he has become the avenger of the government. And there's this movement. Yeah, he actually has a following.
Oh, sure. Understand.
And this, the execution of him by the state may simply be motivation for some of these other critters to come out of the woodwork and do exactly the same thing on this wonderful April day.
Now, isn't that interesting? We were talking before how the ideal solution may be monetarily unaffordable. Now, if the ideal solution, which is because he committed this heinous crime, he ought to be executed, if you've got good reason to believe that these militias are going to come out of the woodwork and there's going to be loss of life. Now the question is, are we going to do justice? I don't care what the consequences are. I mean, now it's a, geez, that's incredible, you know? It's just like the people that sat on the jury for to determine whether those officers that beat Rodney King, you know, used excessive violence. Well, just suppose, put yourself in that position. Suppose that after they went through all this, that they concluded that the officers did not use excessive violence. They really didn't. I mean, that's their considered view. And so their considered view is that these people are not guilty. And the name of justice, they should return a verdict of not guilty. But suppose they know that if they return a verdict of not guilty, L.A. is going to burn.
That's right.
Well, now, wait a minute here. I mean, justice, no matter what?
No.
I mean, does anything ever trump justice? Let the justice roll down like waters? I don't care what the consequences are with life.
Well, it's interesting how this sort of dovetails with the Genesis topic today.
Thanks for coming.
Cain and Abel, the first murder.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that situation, we didn't kill Cain.
No, we didn't.
Cain wasn't an aggravated murder. He would have been a first degree murder, but it wouldn't have been an aggravated. We wouldn't have killed him today.
I was waiting for your argument, which says, we haven't tried capitalism yet. How do we know it deterred? Because we're only
killing. But you turn that argument around. I don't think we've given life imprisonment a chance, because usually if we say life in prison, we really don't mean it. Right? So we've never really given a test to see whether, even if capital punishment is more feared than life imprisonment, it may not logically follow that it's going to be a greater deterrent. That's just what we don't know. It could be the life imprisonment if we meant it.
I don't, but we've never tried it. I don't believe that the vast majority of those crimes, when you really look at them, the people are given enough rational time to think about in terms of deterrent. The vast majority, the hallmark is the denial pattern is there. They're not going to get caught. They're not going to get, they're not in jeopardy anyway. And if it's an accident, then they do.
So I think if you favor capital punishments, probably your trump card argument probably argue for the retributive position, and then so far as there are any good arguments for deterrence, we use them as piggyback or support arguments. But that can't be the foundation. Would you agree?
for it. Yeah, I mean, you can't prove
I wouldn't hang it all on
you can't prove anything. And as soon as you do, there's always the case specific that shows it isn't. I mean, you cannot. I don't think all of them. I mean, there's a little judge out there to try. And the question is I mean, for me at least, is does society have a right to choose what they're choosing? You know, we have been a non-death penalty society.
So I heard I think she took them someplace.
We're a little frustrated with that. You know, for whatever reason the public has, and you get 50 people who get 50 reasons.
I'll tell you what happened in that. What is your first name?
Darryl.
Tell you what happened in our state, Wisconsin. We prided ourselves, like our sister state of Minnesota, we talk about Minnesota nice. And
right, right. Yeah.
We don't have, we're one of 16 states that don't have it and proud of it. Mm-hmm. And man, the Shaking the Foundations game with Jeff Dahmer.
Sure. Exactly.
Oh my God. You know, after he's convicted in our state and all we can give him is life in prison, you got to be kidding. That's a.
Well, there are people too dangerous to be in the world. There's two people too dangerous to be in the world. But true life in prison without possibility of parole takes that debate away, which is what Washington State has. If you're convicted of aggravated first degree murder, you have either life in prison without parole or the death penalty decided by the jury. Jury's decided 7 times that they want to kill somebody, and they've decided the rest of the time, we've had like 41 of them that have gotten life without possibility of parole. And that is the true, we're housing forever, they're too dangerous to be out here. You know, I have often kind of wondered about the Wisconsins of the world, why they didn't do that. If you're going to say we're going to do life imprisonment, why don't we step it up? So it's truly, life imprisonment. Because we do have a life imprisonment that you can get out after. You know, 17 years right. too, but you know.
But there's a kind of mentality in Wisconsin. I don't know whether we're just oversympathetic, whether we got funny kind of genes or something. There's always this sort of feeling that if there's ever any point in a prisoner's tenure in which the person is contrite, you know, people age in prison, or maybe they were firebrands, you know, at the age of 20 or something, but you sort of outgrow that, and there may be just really good, upon psychological examination, eminently good reason as to why you could release this guy, and he's not going to be a... But you say, well, I'm sorry, we said mandatory, and we mean mandatory, so we're going to take this big hit for all this tax money supported, because we can't go back on our words, even though we could release him. Now, it seems a little stupid.
Tremendous argument on that one, because we're just now starting to get geriatric prisoners. Just starting. They're tip of the iceberg, and those boys are real expensive. You know, this lady was...
Oh, because you've got to bankroll all the health care.
Absolutely. We're talking about this guy who is going to hang or some way, probably be executed, who is dying of kidney failure, and, you know, yes, he has a right, supposedly, under the statutes of the state, to a kidney replacement. I think the governor just stepped in and blocked it and said, I'm not going to do it. But the reality is, the guy probably had a right to do it. Geriatrics in prison are real expensive. They're 10 times as expensive as a normal prison. And they're also almost...
If I were Jimmy the Greek in Vegas, I would think that the probability of this guy getting a liver, giving all the people waiting in line for livers on a priority list, is going to be pretty small.
Well, yeah, it isn't going to happen. It isn't going to happen, and the guy's probably going to die before he gets to the hangman. But the reality is, it points up all those issues. Mm-hmm. You know, and the geriatric prison population is escalating dramatically as we start holding these people for longer and longer and longer periods of time. And they're a relatively harmless population. I mean, the number of recidivists at that age level is almost nil.
And you know, the interesting thing was...
Yeah, but you can't level. I mean,
go ahead. A guy that teaches criminology at my school, he came and just threw on my desk one day an article from Newsweek, which I've got in here, and boy, was this arresting. Remember that argument, the second version of the insurance argument, somebody says, if we kill somebody, he ain't going to kill again, I mean, for sure, right. You know, we're buying protection. Well, what this article does, you sort of look at this thing with a more theoretical point of view, and somebody said, okay, let's just reason backwards and ask how much public protection, of the public safety, we would buy if we executed every single convicted murder. Now, how do you get some stats on this? Well, you could shadow do this by saying, well, how about the states that don't have telecommunication? All I can meet out is, okay, how many of those prisoners convicted of first-degree murder carve up wardens, other inmates, guard, I mean, how many commit murder again? How many that are released on parole because the parole board judges that they're safe to go out, commit murder again, and it's astonishing. It's less than 1%.
Oh yeah, it's almost zero.
Holy smokes. Well, that tells you how much safety we're buying if we kill them all. Right. I mean, not much.
Exactly. Yeah, that argument of doesn't hold weight against any statistical basis. That is not the right.
But they have less of a recidivist rate than that argument is
advocated by people who are basically talking about revenge, but they got to have a rational explanation for it. That's my opinion. I mean, there is no rational argument to say that because you murder once, you'll murder again. It doesn't happen. You know? And again, it goes back to typically most murders, 80% are crimes of passion. You only have to be through the system once, but that passion is not the issue anymore. And those that are cold motivations, I mean, Timothy McVeigh probably would murder again, because that's a whole different motivation. That's just necessary body count. That was just war. That guy is a different ballgame. That one is the argument for he won't do it again. That's one of the few guys you'll ever come up with. That's an argument for
that's
that.
That's a good point.
You know, because he will do it again, well, I mean, as long as he believes what he believes. And if he won't, his buddy will. That's the nature, because that's, if you want to call it fanatic or whatever, but he thinks he's obeying a higher good.
Yep.
A high body count was important to get the public's attention. He was doing good. He wasn't doing bad.
Yeah, he was successful.
He wasn't evil.
I mean, this is not somebody who is under drug influence. I mean, this is ideology.
Exactly.
I mean, that's really spooky. That's
scary. If we got that from Iran, we wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah.
If that came from, you know, Baghdad, we wouldn't be shocked.
Hamas.
Right. But if we get it from a Marine, we think that's a terrible concept. No, come on. But you're in Washington, we're just across the border from Idaho. We got lots of people between here and Idaho that believe what Timothy McVeigh believes. You know, this state has lots of those people. You know. Hopefully they won't come to Wisconsin and Minnesota, because it won't be the land of the nice anymore.
You know, they're a product of our culture. You know, and I think that's.
And they come here because they can exist here with relatively free of control, and but they're here. You know, I mean, you go due east of here 200 miles, and two out of three people would think that McVeigh wasn't a bad guy.
Yeah, we have a county in this state that has a total of two black people in the whole county.
What?
Two black people in the whole county.
And the rest of nobody else is dumb enough to go there.
The rest of them are all white. We have
county commissioners who do things like remove the fringes on the flags because that makes it some sort of military flag instead of a county flag, etc. I mean, you know, you talk about the Posse Comitatus in North Dakota. It was nothing what they were rolling out here. It's basically the north end of Seattle, or north end of Idaho and eastern Washington. But there's a lot of people that believe that, you know. It's easy to think McVeigh's a nut. McVeigh is a nut, but he's got a lot of friends. You know, that Weaver standoff that really started the whole thing was
Ruby
there
Ridge,
in North Idaho, right?
Yeah,
Ruby Ridge is the trigger that got all this going, but those people were, you know, thinking that way before Ruby Ridge. Ruby Ridge was, I mean, when you think about it, that was probably an overreaction, because all the guy did was some weapons violations. Those were not horrendous offenses that he committed prior to the agents going after him. But like a lot of places in the United States, Nevada and maybe Arizona, parts of Arizona, people think that, you know, game agent comes on your property, you got a right to shoot him, get him on. You know, the government is evil. And that is the perception.
I just want to comments. I enjoyed your presentation.
Well, I bet you want to eat. That's why you came down to cook.
Yeah. Very well, thanks.
I wouldn't want you to start this. Yes, I was. Thank you for the discussion.
Examples.
Pardon?
I would encourage you to be gender neutral in your examples. Give some women examples of killers instead of just stereotyping men.
Thank you.
Well, I'm in the men's movement, so I'm a little more sensitive.
Yeah.
So I'm just
it's not probably, it, I'm probably, I don't usually do that, by the way. This is a particular subject matter which lends itself to the use of he and him, because most first degree murders just happen to be male. I mean, you know, and so you feel as though you're talking to the huge majority.
But that's
huge into
a whole other issue, which
you're
is
right. You're right. You're right.
Thing. But anyways, I don't mean it to be as strong as the minutes. Well, thanks. What's up here?
Well, I don't know what's up.
When are you potting or throwing your pots?
Well, I kind of set a time up.